Can you hear that? Can you hear that? That is me greasing myself up. I'm covering myself from the top of my head to the bottom of my toes, head to foot in grease. So I'm all greased up so I can slide smoothly into your ear holes. Run the theme music.
What's this? What's this?
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
What's this? What's this?
It's Christmas time.
What's this? What's this?
It's all humbug, I tell you.
What's this? What's this?
Well, says team, a trusty old Red Rider carbine action 2 on the shot range model air rifle.
What is this?
It's the Total Christmas Podcast with your host, Jack.
He's an angry elf.
Well, that's just what you need, isn't it, eh? A greasy man inside your ears. Well, here I am, in your ears, baby. Hello, you beautiful people, and welcome to episode one more than the previous one of the Total Christmas Podcast. It's so good to be here. I just got to say, you are looking beautiful. Do you know who looks beautiful? I tell you someone who's really beautiful. You! You're beautiful! And you're listening to my show. Thanks for being here. Do you want to do the interactive bit? No? You don't want to? We're going to do it anyway. You ready? Here it comes. How are you? Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I'm good. Yeah, do you know what? I'm happy. I'm really happy. Do you know why I'm happy? Because you're beautiful. And scene. How was that? Uplifting? Let's hope so. So, I've got a few things to talk about, actually. No, I haven't. I've got one thing to talk about. I've got an email from my new best friend. I don't know if I've ever told you this. I've got a new best friend. His name's Chris Kavanagh. He's my self-appointed best friend. It's nice having a best friend. Makes me feel loved. We're there for each other. Well, when I say there for each other, he emails me every month or so, and then I email him back. It's kind of a nice relationship. We've got a close relationship. No idea what he looks like. I imagine he's beautiful, though. Anyway, he emailed me. I'm going to read out what he said. Here it comes. So he started his email, is about 30 paragraphs of explaining how bad the podcast is and improvements I could make. But then he said, I was moved by your mention of Neil Diamond's Christmas music. This might sound a bit odd, but Neil Diamond's music, particularly his non-Christmas tunes, has a special place in my heart during the holiday season. My mum was a huge Neil Diamond fan, and during my school Christmas breaks, she would often play his songs, more than she normally would for some reason. They weren't classic holiday songs per se, but they became a significant part of my Christmas memories because of the frequency with which they were played in our house. So in a way, Neil Diamond's music became a soundtrack of my holiday season. My mum passed away a few years ago, and those memories of her during Christmas with Neil Diamond's music playing in the background are some of the best ones I have. It's funny how a song like Heartlight can take me back instantly to 1982 and I'm decorating the Christmas tree. Just wanted to let you know that it all resonated with me on a deeply personal level, and I just wanted to thank you for that unexpected connection and for the memories it brought back. It was nice, wasn't it? And then at the end he put, it got me thinking, maybe a potential topic, does anyone else out there have songs added to their Christmas playlist that aren't holiday songs? And he's also put, my guess is for UK listeners, the answer is absolutely, because you have those Christmas number one things every year, and those tend to not be Christmas songs, but just had me wondering about elsewhere. And he also asked, what is the history of that Christmas number one concept over there? I suppose I could Google it, but yeah, maybe it's potential content for me. And it is potential content, and it is, well, it's not just potential content, it's happening. I'm just going to explain it briefly now, okay? The first ever number one in the UK was actually a Christmas number one. Well, that's when the charts first started in the 1950s. I'm not going to go into it because it wasn't a big thing in the 50s or the 60s. Like, having a number one single, that was a thing. But the actual being the Christmas number one wasn't really a big thing. But in 1973, there was a battle between two of the biggest glam rock bands of the time. That was Slade with Merry Christmas, Everybody, is a little bit.
So here is Merry Christmas.
And also, the other band was Wizard with, I think you'll recognise this.
Oh, well, I wish it could be Christmas every day.
they both released Christmas singles at about the same time, and they were both seeing who could win to get to the Christmas number one. Now, I'm not going to go into the story of how the battle commenced, but when Slade won, at the time, the biggest chart show on TV was called Top of the Pops. It's still going now, but only at Christmas time. We have like a Christmas Top of the Pops. It used to be on every week, and it was the most watched music show in the country. And when Slade were on stage filming their recording of Merry Christmas, Everybody, the guys from Wizard came in and threw custard pies at them, apparently. I think it was good-natured, but I could be wrong. And that set the scene for following years. And ever since then, the Christmas number one has been like a major thing, and everyone's trying to get that Christmas number one. I thought it was a big deal in every country. But when I was 18, I went to Australia, and I spent Christmas out there. I was backpacking, and I couldn't believe that no one seemed to care what the number one was at Christmas. It really surprised me, because it was such a major thing in the UK. So yeah, that's the story. That's why it started. That's why it's a big thing now. So I hope that answers your question, Chris. Now, just going back to what he said, I'd be really interested if there is anyone out there that has got songs that aren't Christmas songs that remind them of Christmas. Now, like he said, in the UK, we do have the big Christmas number one, and most songs that get to number one at Christmas are not Christmas songs. Often they're novelty songs, or often they're just songs by whoever's popular at the time. And although for the last 5 years, it's been the same guy releasing his songs about sausage rolls, which is for a good cause, but it annoys me. It really annoys me. But of the songs that actually get to number one at Christmas, the ones that do become regular Christmas songs that aren't Christmas related have a Christmas feel to them, if that makes sense. So most songs that are Christmas number ones, they don't get airplay every Christmas unless they're Christmas themed. Although a few, not many, but a few have sort of made it through. And I'm just wondering if you've got songs that aren't Christmas related that do remind you of Christmas. If you have, I'd love to hear it, and hopefully I'll get a few emails about this and I can read them out one time. If you haven't, make it up, just so that I've got some content. Right, so that's that covered. Now let's move on, and oh, thanks again, Chris. You know I love you. Now it's time for this. This is the quiz, this is the quiz, this is the quiz, this is the quiz. Boys and girls, girls and boys, you are cool. Thank you very much. It's the quiz. It's your favourite part of the show. It's why you've downloaded the show, isn't it? I'm your quiz master, Jack. I've got 10 questions. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you those 10 questions. You're going to answer those 10 questions, and then we're going to find out if you got them right. It's very simple. If you have a pen and paper, you could write it down. If you haven't got a pen and paper, you can't write it down, can you? Although you could do it on your phone. But you've got to type pretty quickly with your answer. Because once I've asked one question, what I do next is I ask another question. Yeah, I know. And do you know what I do after that? Another one. I do that 10 times. 10 questions. We've been through this. And then I give you 10 answers. And what you've got to do is you've got to look to see if your answers are correct. Then you add up how many you got right, then you look at your score and you think, is that it? And then you feel bad for the rest of the day. So, let's get started with question number one. The 2003 Cold Turkey Christmas, that's what the name of the episode was, Christmas episode of which sitcom were the goings on a bit too much for Patsy, who wound up in hospital on drugs? 2003, who was that? Question number two. Which late giant of soul and funk music? He wasn't actually a proper giant. He wasn't like 10 foot tall. Okay, he was normal human sized. Okay, where was I? Oh yeah. Which late giant of soul and funk music recorded the 1968 album A Soulful Christmas, whose opening track is Santa Claus Goes Straight to the Ghetto? Do you know what? They missed the trick there, because they didn't even mention the fact that he actually died on Christmas Day as well. I can't believe they missed that out. Well, fair enough, attitude. Right, question number, I don't care. In which 1954 musical Christmas film are the songs Count Your Blessings Instead of Sheep and Gee, I Wish I Was Back in the Army? What musical were those songs in? Hey? Right, question number whatever. These are lyrics from which carol? I'm not going to sing them, okay? That makes it harder for you. To you in David's town this day is born of David's line the Saviour, who is Christ the Lord. And this shall be the sign. Okay, next one. Sparkle, jolly, twinkle, jingly. Never fall in love. I'll believe in you. And nobody cares about Santa. Are songs in what stage musical based on the original 2003 film of the same name? Got that one? Right, next one. Only published as a collection in 1976, who, between 1920 and 1943, wrote Letters from Father Christmas for his children? Do you know what? I'm going to give you this. I wasn't going to bother, but I'm going to give you this, okay? They've given you two answers. It's a 50-50 chance. You ready? Was it C.S. Lewis? He's the guy who wrote The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and all that stuff. Or was it J.R.R. Tolkien? He's the one who wrote Game of Thrones. It wasn't. It was, he's the one who wrote Lord of the Rings. That was a hilarious joke. Right, question summing. Ebenezer Scrooge's famous line, "Bah humbug," in A Christmas Carol almost never existed. Charles Dickens' initial choice was "Bah what?" Next one. From which 2004 film is the line, "The thing about trains, it doesn't matter where they're going, what matters is deciding to get on." Oh, we're at number 9 now. Oxford dictionaries say that the name for what type of Christmas decoration derives from the old French word that means spark or sparkle. And last question. Frank Bruno, he's a boxer, a British boxer. He fought Mike Tyson in the late 80s, early 90s, I forget which. Frank Bruno's full first name is Frankincense. Is that true or is that false? That was question number 10. Right, are you ready for your answers? Okay, here they come. I won't lie to you, kids. I thought that was a tricky one this time. Question number 1. The 2003 Cold Turkey Christmas episode of which sitcom were the goings-on a bit too much for Patsy, who wound up in hospital on drugs? That, of course, was absolutely fabulous. That Patsy line should have given that away to you. Which late giant of soul and funk music recorded the 1968 album A Soulful Christmas, whose opening track is Santa Claus Goes Straight to the Ghetto? That was James Brown, of course, who did die, sadly, on Christmas Day in 2006. Yeah, 2006. That was like 16 years ago. Goodness me, 16 years ago. Wow. Okay. In which 1954 musical Christmas film are the songs Count Your Blessings Instead of Sheep and Gee, I Wish I Was Back in the Army? That, of course, is White Christmas. Do you know what's funny? Apparently, I haven't gone through the playlist, but I read somewhere that the only Christmas song in White Christmas is actually the song White Christmas. I think maybe you could sort of say Snow, because it's sort of Christmassy, but the only one that really talks about Christmas is White Christmas. There you go. Question number 4. Yeah, I'm paying attention today. Yeah, 4. These are lyrics from which carol? I'm going to sing them now. It'll make it easier for you. To you in David's town this day is born of David's line, the Saviour who is Christ the Lord, and this shall be the sign. That was, of course, While Shepherds Watched Their Flocks by Night. Okay, next one. Sparkle Jolly, Twinkle Jingly, Never Fall in Love, I'll Believe in You, and Nobody Cares About Santa are songs in what stage musical based on the original 2003 film of the same name? That was Elf. There you go. Elf the musical. Next one. Published as a collection in 1976, who between 1920 and 43 wrote Letters from Father Christmas? Was it C.S. Lewis or was it J.R.R. Tolkien? It was Tolkien. Yeah, it was J.R.R. Tolkien. And you know what's sad is I thought it was C.S. Lewis. So I've made a fool of myself. Okay, next one. Ebenezer Scrooge's famous line, "Bah humbug," in A Christmas Carol almost never existed. Charles Dickens' initial choice was "Bah what?" And the answer is "Bah, bah, black sheep." Yeah, apparently that was it. Scrooge was going to continually sing "Bah, bah, black sheep." Okay, next one. No, I'm kidding. It was Dickens' initial choice was "Bah, what a load of old shit." Oh, that's bad, wasn't it? There's no need for that word, was there? Shall I bleep it out? Shall I go back and bleep it out? I'll do the bleep now. Imagine I did it when I said the word. Beep! How's that? Has that sort of made you feel better? Probably. No, right. The actual word was Bar Christmas. He was just going to go, Christmas. Yeah, I'm glad he changed it. Yeah, I have talked about what humbug means. It's not just like an utterance, as in like, you know, what a load of old crap. In fact, I'll tell you something interesting. P.T. Barnum, you know the one in The Greatest Showman, yeah? Hugh Jackman, Yeah, played P.T. Barnum. P.T. Barnum actually wrote a book about the humbugs of the world, and a humbug was like a con or a scam. Really good book, actually. I've listened to the audiobook of it. Highly recommended. Right, next one. From which 2004 film is the line, "The thing about trains, it doesn't matter where they're going, what matters is deciding to get on"? Can you believe I didn't get this one? And when I saw the answer, it's like, what? How did I not get that? You know, I took the girls to see it at the cinema because they had it on at Christmas. So we went to see it, Christmas just gone. I've heard that line dozens of times. And what other film could it be? It was the Polar Express, of course. Never got that. Unbelievable. I'm a fool. Right. Oxford dictionaries say that the name for what type of... Right, this is how the question actually is, right? And I left out a little bit to make it trickier, right? Oxford dictionaries say that the name for what type of Christmas decoration derives from the old French word estincelle. Estincelle. It sounds exactly like tinsel, meaning spark. Well, I just said it comes from the old French word that means spark, because I didn't want you to know that it's estincel, which sounds just like tinsel, which is what the answer is. And I did cover that, actually, back in, I think it might have been episode 3, was it? Where I talked about tinsel. If you haven't listened to episode 3, go and listen to him. He's sad and lonely because he's so old now, people don't go and visit him. Go and visit episode 3. And 2 and 1 and 4 as well. And 5, 6, 7, all the way up to 81. Right, and 82. This is 82. Last question. Frank Bruno's first full name is Frankincense. True or false? Do you know what I put? I put true. It ain't true. It's false. Why did I fall for that? What kind of nincompoop am I? Do you know how many I've scored? This is my worst one yet. Do you know how many I've scored? 5. Yeah. I'll tell you what I didn't get. I didn't know it was Bar Christmas. I'm annoyed at that. I didn't know that Frankincense one. Didn't know the blooming Polar Express. I didn't know those songs from Elf the Musical. I've only seen it once, but I should have known that. I should have guessed it. And also, I guess C.S. Lewis instead of J.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R. Tolkien. Yeah. Anyway, I hope you did better than 5. Good luck to you. That's the end of the quiz. Let's do this.
Do you hear what I hear?
Do you hear what I hear?
Bob's here, boys and girls, and now he's going to be telling you why we call it a pub. Take it away, Bob.
They say that love makes the world go round, but alcohol makes it go round twice as fast. Now, I suppose we can't be called total Christmas without embracing the naughty and the nice. For every Santa, elf, and angel, there has to be a Scrooge, a Grinch, and of course, a gremlin. You remember them? They were like a nightmare Looney Tunes cartoon come to life. They were just as funny, but with real violence. Now in the movie Gremlins, Gizmo's owner Billy has a girlfriend who works at Dory's Pub as a waitress. Now you may remember it. They wanted to make it a landmark, and the gremlins later invade it and have a party. The notable thing about Dory's is that it is located in the States and uses the word pub in the name. I mean, we do have many establishments here that use the term pub to give it an old English feel. So we know what the word means. We also have pub crawls here, like the Santa ones that I spoke about in Wonderful Christmas Time. The strange thing is, while we may use the term as a colorful business name, we just don't use the word pub in conversation. Americans will say, "Hey, let's go to the bar." Now, our friends in the UK do say pub, and probably because, well, that's where they were born. The word is shortened from the original term public house, which meant in the 1500s, any building open to the public. Then later, in the 1600s, it became the name for an inn that provides food and sells ale and wine. And finally, the shortened slang word pub became commonly used in the 17th century to describe a drinking establishment that served alcoholic drinks for consumption on the premises. So then, why do us Yanks say bar? Well, that comes from the practice of separating the space where the alcohol is served from the rest of the establishment. And there are a few theories. In early colonial days in the US, the local operator was often a widow and the only person who worked there. So there were a set of iron bars suspended from the ceiling that could be lowered to keep the alcohol secure when the server had to leave to get stock or tend to the horses. Or some say that the term is a reference to how the space or the counter over which the drinks are served is like a barrier, so it's a bar. Or people will claim it's because of the bar that runs along the bottom of the counter that is used as a footrest. Whatever your phrase, don't set that bar too high. There are few things more pleasant to consider than a good old English pub. Cheers and happy Christmas.
I love that segment. It's so interesting, and that's true. You know, that's why we call it a pub. I think most people, adults, would know that when you say pub, you know it's a public house, because back in the days it was a house that was open to the public to go in and have a drink. The funny thing is, we call certain establishments bars. A pub and a bar are sort of different places. Yeah, I don't know how you differentiate. A pub is normally just out on its own, although you do get pubs on the high street. But normally bars are more likely to be on the high street. There's just a general difference in atmosphere, I think, really. Hard to pinpoint exactly the difference. Tell you this, though. We actually call the bit where the drinks are served the bar. So you'd be stood up at the bar. So you're in a pub at the bar. Yeah, there you go. Anyway, thank you so much for that, Bob. We'll see him again later on. But right now, it's time for this. Boys and girls, the last few episodes, all this year, I've been doing my joke from the toilet roll that my wife gave me for Christmas, right? And I won't lie to you, I've listened back and I'm a bit down on these jokes. Like, oh, this one's another awful joke. And I don't think that's a good way to deliver the joke, okay? So I'm going to be a bit more upbeat, and this one is actually a really, really good one. Here it comes. Are you ready? What do snowmen have for breakfast? Ice Krispies! Hey, get it? Because there's made of snow. Snow's like ice. Ice Krispies sounds like Rice Krispies. It's hilarious. Thank goodness for that. I'm glad we had a funny one. For a change. Holy cow. Right, let's go. What the dickens? Boys and girls, I've done What the Dickens for a few episodes. I'm doing it now, you lucky people. So I like to have a theme about the things I talk about in the What the Dickens segment, and this week I'm going to be talking about some of the references that Dickens uses in A Christmas Carol, where he talks about other people or other literary characters. So first up, I'm going to play this for you.
Foggier yet and colder, piercing, searching, biting cold. If the good St. Dunstan had but nipped the evil spirit's nose with a touch of such weather as that, instead of using his familiar weapons, then indeed he would have roared to lusty purpose. The owner of one scant young nose, gnawed and mumbled by the hungry cold as bones are gnawed by dogs, stooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol.
So he mentions St. Dunstan. Now this is interesting, this is very interesting, but I'm not going to go into it as deep as I could because this isn't really Christmas related, it's A Christmas Carol related. But I do want to tell you a bit about the story of St. Dunstan because, like I say, it's really interesting. St. Dunstan was this monk, right, and he lived in Glastonbury, in the UK, obviously, and he lived as a hermit in like a very small house, it was a single room he lived in, and he'd practice his worship and play his harp, and he also was into sort of crafts, particularly metalwork. And he's working away, and the devil tried to tempt him. Now, I'm going to read out the story for you. That's probably the easiest way to do this. One day, as evening was coming, an old man appeared at St. Dunstan's window and asked him to make him a chalice. Setting aside what he was working on, Dunstan agreed to the request and set to work. But as he was working, his visitor began to change shape. One minute he was an old man, then a young boy, then a seductive woman. Dunstan realised that his guest was the devil, but pretending not to notice, he went on with his task. He took up the tongs from among his tools and laid them in the fire, waiting until they were red hot. Then, pulling them out of the fire, he turned round and seized the devil by the nose with the tongs. The devil struggled and screamed, but Dunstan held on until at last he felt he had triumphed. Then he threw the devil out of his cell and it fled running down the street and crying, "Woe is me! What has that bold devil done to me? Look at me, a poor wretch! Look how he has tortured me!" Many people heard and saw this, and the following day they came to Dunstan and asked him what had happened. He said to them, "These are the tricks of devils who try to trap us with their snares whenever they can. But if we remain firm in the service of Christ, we can easily defeat them with his help, and they will flee from us in confusion." And what's great is there's even more legends have come from that story. So the first one is that apparently the tongs have been preserved to this day at a place called Mayfield. The second is that the devil ran off all the way from Mayfield to cool his nose in the strings of Tunbridge Wells. And that's how the famous waters of Tunbridge Wells have got their reddish tint, although it probably is down to the fact that there's a lot of iron in the water. And the alternatively to the previous bit about Mayfield, right, he flew away with the tongs still attached to his nose and they dropped off in a place near Brighton, which is now called Tongdean for obvious reasons. So there you go. That's the first story of St. Dunstan. Now this next one, not related to what Dickens mentions in A Christmas Carol, but it's such an interesting story, I've got to read it out to you. So, this legend also occurred in Mayfield when the convent there had just been built. The devil appeared to St. Dunstan and said that he was going to knock down all the houses in the village. St. Dunstan bargained with the devil and got him to agree to leave standing any house with a horseshoe on the outside. So the devil agreed. But St. Dunstan managed to nail a horseshoe to all the houses in the village before the devil could get to them, and the village was saved. So I actually read a different version of that one, and what this one is the devil comes to Dunstan and says, "Oh, could you shoe my horse?" Because he knew Dunstan did the ironwork. And Dunstan is like, "Yeah, no problem." And he gets one of the horseshoes and grabs the devil's cloven hoof and puts the horseshoe on the devil. And the devil's like, "Ah, that's really painful. Ah, don't like that." And because of that reason, that's the reason why people put horseshoes on their door for good luck. So there you go. That apparently is the reason why we use horseshoes for good luck. Would you believe it? I'm amazed by that. I never knew that, and now I know it because of looking into A Christmas Carol. So the next bit, right, there's a few I'm going to cover here, so let's just play it.
The spirit touched him on the arm and pointed to his younger self, intent upon his reading. Suddenly, a man in foreign garments, wonderfully real and distinct to look at, stood outside the window, with an axe stuck in his belt and leading an ass laden with wood by the bridle. "Why, it's Ali Baba!" Scrooge exclaimed in ecstasy. "It's dear old honest Ali Baba. Yes, yes, I know. One Christmas time, when yonder solitary child was left here all alone, he did come for the first time, just like that. Poor boy, and Valentine," said Scrooge, "and his wild brother Orson, there they go, and what's his name, who was put down in his drawers, asleep at the gate of Damascus, don't you see him, and the Sultan's groom turned upside down by the genie, there he is upon his head, serve him right, I'm glad of it, what business had he to be married to the princess?" Dear Scrooge, expending all the earnestness of his nature on such subjects, in a most extraordinary voice between laughing and crying, and to see his heightened and excited face, would have been a surprise to his business friends in the city indeed. "There's the parrot!" cried Scrooge. "Green body and yellow tail, with a thing like a lettuce growing out of the top of his head. There he is! Poor Robin Crusoe, he called him when he came home again after sailing round the island. Poor Robin Crusoe, where have you been, Robin Crusoe?" The man thought he was dreaming, but he wasn't. It was the parrot, you know. There goes Friday, running for his life to the little creek. "Hello! Hope! Hello!" Then, with a rapidity of transition very foreign to his usual character, he said in pity for his former self, "Poor boy!" and cried again.
So that's a very interesting scene because it's left out of most versions of A Christmas Carol. I think I've seen three versions where they actually did keep this scene in the book. And pretty much what it is the young Scrooge is sat there reading and we sort of see what he's imagining in the books that he reads. And it comes from a few different stories. So the first one is he sees Ali Baba, and that is from the story Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves from the Arabian Nights. And apparently, as I was studying this, the Arabian Nights is the second most common work of literature that Dickens references in his books. The most common reference is from Shakespeare's writings. But yeah, the second most common is references he makes to the stories from the Arabian Nights. So that's the first one. The second one he mentions was Valentine and Orson, and this is a French romance story, and the story goes that the sons of the emperor, although I've got a feeling it might have been the nephews of the emperor of France, were separated at birth. They were called Valentine and Orson. One was raised by a bear and became like a wild man in the forest, and the other was raised as a knight in the king's court. But eventually they were reunited and Orson was restored to his birthright. The next one is where he talks about what's his name, and this again is from the Arabian Nights, and when he says about the Sultan's groom, and I'm gonna have to read this out to you, this bit, so that you get the story. Again, this is these two bits, what's his name and the Sultan's groom, are both from one of the stories from the Arabian Nights. So these two are both characters in Noureddin Ali of Cairo and his son Bedreddin Hassan. And a genie tells Bedreddin Hassan of a woman equal to him in beauty. But the vizier's daughter is already promised to another, who is a sultan's hunchbacked dwarf. The genie transports Bedreddin to the palace and displaces the hideous husband-to-be with the handsome young man, and has spirits hang the dwarf upside down during the wedding night, which is really a proper arsehole move, if you ask me. It's, you know, I mean, it's not his fault, that's the way he is. He's a dwarf and he's got a hunchback, and that's how they treat the poor sod. Okay, where was I? Yeah, they hang the dwarf upside down during the wedding night. The genie must return before morning with Bedreddin still in his bedclothes. But as they are passing over Damascus, dawn breaks and Bedreddin is left at the city gates. He finds employment as a cook, and after a dozen years, he is finally reunited with his wife and their son, born while he was away. There you go, that's the story. Interesting one, wasn't it? I hope Scheherazade did a better job of telling that story than I did. Anyway, and the fourth and final story that is referenced there when young Scrooge is imagining what he's reading is Robinson Crusoe, of course, and it's the parrot that he had who would talk to him, and he taught him to speak, and the parrot would say, "Poor Robin Crusoe, poor Robin Crusoe." There you go. Right, now I better play the next bit. Here it comes.
His hands were busy with his garments all this time, turning them inside out, putting them on upside down, tearing them, mislaying them, making them parties to every kind of extravagance. "I don't know what to do," cried Scrooge, laughing and crying in the same breath, and making a perfect Laocoon one of himself with his stockings.
He says Scrooge was making a perfect Laocoon of himself in his stockings. Now, this is an interesting story again. This is the story of Laocoon. I'm sort of pronouncing that right. I looked it up on Google of how to pronounce it, and that's what I'm going with. Laocoon, he was a Trojan priest, and during the Trojan War, at the very end, you know, when they bring in the Trojan horse and all the Greeks are hiding inside it, Laocoon was like, "Look, we should just burn that down, burn it down." And everyone's like, "Well, hold on a minute, you know, let's bring it in, it's a gift." And he's like, "No, we need to burn that, I don't trust it." If they'd listened to him, they would have been all right, wouldn't they, the old Trojans? They made fools of themselves, should have listened to him. But because of this, this offended the goddess Athena, because she obviously liked the Greeks more, and Athena sent two great sea serpents to go and strangle him and his two sons. Yeah. And so the idea is that as he's putting his stockings on, he's all getting wrapped up and tangled in them, the same way that Laocoon was being tangled up and strangled to death by a great big sea serpent. So that's what he means when he says making a perfect Laocoon of himself. And the next one...
"I'll send it to Bob Cratchit's," whispered Scrooge, rubbing his hands and splitting with a laugh. "He shan't know who sends it. It's twice the size of Tiny Tim. Joe Miller never made such a joke as sending it to Bob's will be."
This is actually a real figure when he talks about Joe Miller. And this one's interesting as well. They're all interesting. I keep saying that. I keep telling you they're interesting. But you don't have to take my word for it. I'll just prove it by telling you that Joe Miller was a popular but illiterate English comic whose purported jokes and sayings were collected by the dramaticist John Motley in Joe Miller's Jest Book. And the book itself may have been a joke, but apparently it sold by the bucket load. It became the best known English collection of witticisms, and almost any stray joke was attributed to this apparently unfunny person. And also the term a Joe Miller became the term for a stale and old joke. Now, I've got a couple of jokes here that were in that book, but apparently this book didn't necessarily actually have anything to do with Joe Miller. The book was sort of mocking Joe Miller when they brought it out. Anyway, this is the first one. It's not too bad, actually. I'll read them both out to you. A lady's age happening to be questioned, she affirmed she was but 40 and called upon a gentleman that was in company for his opinion. "Cousin," said she, "do you believe I am in the right when I say I am but 40?
"I ought not to dispute it, madam," replied he, "for I have heard you say so these past 10 years.
So, yeah, witty. And the next one. A famous teacher of arithmetic who had long been married without being able to get his wife with child, someone once said to her, "Madam, your husband is an excellent arithmetician." "Yes," replies she, "only he can't multiply." So there you go, two fantastic jokes. Well, they were all right, I think, for their time. I thought they were okay. Anyway, that's why he refers to Joe Miller. So I hope that has cast some light on those things. Next time you're reading A Christmas Carol, maybe you'll understand that little bit more. Now let's move on, and I'm going to do this. Oh, well, did you recognise that tune? Yeah, at the start there. Yeah. Bob's back, boys and gals. And this time, we have another suggestion from a listener. It's Benji Pearson. And I just want to say, Bob, you are looking beautiful.
Well, thank you, Jack. I really have to thank Benji Pearson, our Scandinavian-American correspondent, for this stylish suggestion. It is a good one. And again, it's something that I didn't realize I was doing as well. Benji describes how he was recently out shopping for clothes and he picked up a green shirt and a pair of red shorts. He wasn't looking for Christmas colors, but he realized when he held the outfit together, this is a great hidden way to carry the holiday into the summer. As Benji notes, they don't necessarily look Christmassy to those non-Yule files, but for those of us in the private club, we know. Now, I have two shirts with Santa golfing on them, and I wear them, and they are so subtle, you can't tell unless you look really close. I also have a baseball cap with Santa on it. I may get a few looks when I wear it, but it's great. And finally, I get a lot of Christmas t-shirts for gifts. But where I live in the States, you can't wear short sleeves until May. I used to pack them away with the Christmas stuff, but you know, now I wear them through the warm weather months. They make me happy. Now, if you have a secret celebration that you host every month, it's time to share. You tell Jack, and we will put it on public display in a future segment.
I really like that one. I really like Benji's idea of wearing red and green. It's almost like you're going undercover because someone would look at you and think, oh, that guy over there is wearing red and green. It's like, little do you know, I'm wearing Christmas, buddy. I'm wearing Christmas. Thanks, Benji, and thanks, Bob. Great work again. Now, I just want to give you a little heads up. In the next episode, I'll be making an announcement. Bob's got something that he's been working on that he's going to share with us all, and I'm very excited about it, but you'll have to wait till next episode till I start talking about it. But right now, it's time for this.
Jingle, jingle, jingle for a segment.
Boys and girls, this episode, I want to talk about nativity scenes. Now, did you know that the first ever nativity scene, right, dates back to AD 380? That was the first one they ever found, and it was in the catacombs of St. Valentine. Now, that was the first one, right,
There was probably others in between then and the next one that I'm going to talk about, because I'm going to talk about the first ever real live nativity scene. Now, a lot of you out there probably already knew that the first ever live nativity scene was created by St. Francis of Assisi, because I'm sure other podcasts have talked about it in the past. Now, the account of this comes from the life of St. Francis of Assisi by St. Bonaventure. He wrote this in the year 1260, but apparently the first ever live nativity scene was in 1223. Now, St. Bonaventure, he was born 5 years before St. Francis of Assisi died, so we don't know how accurate this is, but that's the only account we have of it, is from his writings. St. Francis had been to the Holy Lands, and when he was there, he was sort of taken on a tour, and they sort of showed him where they believed the original birthplace of Jesus was, and this inspired him. And when he got back, he created in a cave in Grisio, Italy, a reenactment of what that scene would have been. Now, here's the deal. From what I've read, I don't know what you might have heard, okay? It didn't have Mary and Joseph. It didn't have the three wise men. It had just the... It was like the scene before Mary and Joseph got there. So all it had was an ox and an ass and a manger with hay in it. And apparently there was no baby Jesus either. Now, St. Francis, before he made it, he did make sure that he got the blessing from Pope Honorius III, who was Pope at the time. And he was like, yeah, go on, do what you want. So Francis makes this scene of the ox and the ass and a manger. And like, people came to visit it. And it's like, look, this is what it looked like, the place where Jesus was born. And this made St. Francis incredibly emotional, explaining to people that this is, you know, this is what it was like for him. And the legend goes that he was so overcome with emotion that an apparition of the baby Jesus appeared in the manger. And St. Francis even went up and held this apparition of the baby. Yeah. And then after this, the hay from the manger was preserved by the people that lived in the village, and the hay was believed to hold magical, miraculous properties. It like was healing sick animals and many other pestilences, which is how it was read. So yeah, soon every church in Italy had a nativity scene. So there you go. Now, I don't know when they started adding all the other characters, but that was the first one. And despite what you may have heard, it was literally just a couple of animals and a manger. Now, what I also want to talk about today, and I hope you're going to enjoy this, is the story from 2004 where Madame Tussauds, the waxwork museum in London, in Piccadilly in London, they unveiled their very own nativity scene with, are you ready, David and Victoria Beckham as Mary and Joseph. Yeah, that's right. Also, Kylie Minogue, who is very famous in the UK and Australia, not sure how well she's travelled overseas, very famous singer, she was there as the angel, like hovering above them. I won't lie to you, from the pictures I've seen, she don't look that comfortable sort of hanging there, but there you go. Dear. The three wise men were George W. Bush, Tony Blair, and Prince Philip. Yeah, the Queen's husband, who's since passed away. Yeah, they were the three wise men. And then as the shepherds, you had, and this is interesting, this is random if you ask me, you've got Graham Norton, he's a chat show host, you're probably familiar with him, I know his show's travelled overseas. Graham Norton, Samuel L. Jackson, and Hugh Grant. Those were the shepherds. Yeah. And apparently the baby Jesus, they just had a little doll, because I suppose they didn't want to be too blasphemous by having, I don't know, who could they have had? I can't think of a famous baby. Maybe they could have had the guy that played Mini-Me, Vern Troyer. That would have been bad, wouldn't it? Anyway, the deal was, apparently, and I don't know how true this is, but apparently they had 300 voting ballots where people voted, and then they decided from those ballots who was going to be, you know, playing what characters in their nativity scene. I can't lie to you. Like, how was the ballot? It was like, who do you want to be, Mary? Who do you want to be, Joseph? Did people just put Porsche and Becker? I don't know. 300 people. I don't. Anyway, that's what Madame Tussauds claimed. That's how they did it. And as you can imagine, the religious groups just thought it was fantastic. They thought it was a great way of bringing the nativity scene to the public. Of course, I'm talking rubbish, because as you can imagine, religious groups were in uproar. And I say they were in uproar, but probably what happened was it sort of came out and then the newspapers went to the religious groups and like, yeah, you've seen this, what do you think of this? And they're like, well, I don't think much of it, to be honest. I don't know that it was a massive thing. I wouldn't be surprised if it was sparked by the newspapers rather than, you know, the religious groups deciding that. I don't know. I could be completely wrong. Anyway, apparently there was a huge outcry and protests. I don't know if there really were protests, but that's what I read. I don't know. One man, okay, he was a law lecturer by the name of James Anstice, right? He was 39 at the time. He was particularly outraged by the whole affair. He's like, goodness me, I can't believe they've got David Beckham and Victoria Beckham. I don't know how he spoke, maybe he spoke like that. I can't believe David Beckham and Victoria, she's not a virgin and her name's not Mary. Or something. I don't know what happened. Anyway, he was so angry, right? He went to Madame Tussauds, paid for his ticket, goes in there, right, waits till there's not many people around. Okay, he's looking over his shoulder, right, not many people about, climbs over to the cordon and grabbed. Now, I've read different versions. I thought it was Victoria Beckham's head. Could have been David Beckham. You can imagine this. He's like, right, I'm not having any of this. I'm going to steal one of their heads. So he pulled off. I thought it was Victoria Beckham's. Could have been David's. Someone's head got pulled off, right? Not the real person, the waxwork. Okay, can we go back to that? Right. He's pulled off her head and done a runner, right? As he's running off, he dropped it and it smashed. And they got it on CCTV. And also, they had his credit card details because, you know, he paid for his ticket by credit card. So I suppose this guy watched him back on a CCTV. Oh, there he is paying. Find out. Anyway, they had no trouble finding him. And it all went to court. Yeah, they caught him. And they claimed that it cost £2,500 worth of damage. That is how much the head of the waxwork of David Beckham or Victoria, one of their heads cost. Interesting, really, when you think about it, because that's all really the waxwork is. It's only really the head, isn't it? Because I reckon you could pretty much get away with sticking most people's heads on someone else's waxwork body. Probably wouldn't notice. I don't imagine they're going into too much detail, unless you're covered in tattoos, actually. I know David Beckham is, so maybe, I don't know. Anyway, he got caught. He goes to court. Now, he was a law lecturer, right? So he knows a thing or two about law. So he made his case that he was furious that despite protests from religious groups, Madame Tussauds had done nothing about this. They were quite happy to, you know, carry on with this display of a lot of celebrities pretending to be religious figures. And he claimed it was a protest, not an act of vandalism. And apparently that helped his case. Now, I read a lot of places that he escaped jail time. Now, I can't imagine, really, they're locking people up for crap like that. Really. Even if he'd gone in there and said, oh, I nicked his head because there's a lot of bollocks, I'm pissed off about the whole thing. I reckon even if he'd come in and said that, I think he would have got away with it, because it's not that big a thing. Anyway, point being, he got a 12-month probation, like a suspended sentence, and also he had to pay £155, which, to be honest, if you ask me, is getting off pretty lightly if they're claiming it was £2,500 worth of damage and he's got give us £155 and we'll let you off. I don't know what they did instead with their £155. So how's that going to cover David Beckham's head? I'm trying to think of another waxworks head they could have just popped off, made it look a bit like David Beckham, chucked it on there, but no one springs to mind. Anyway, that's what happened. Some bloke nicked David Beckham's head from a nativity scene. Shall I tell you when I found out about it? It happened in 2004. Pretty much all the papers covered it. Papers all around the world covered it. And do you know when I found out about it? About a week ago, when I started researching on nativity scenes. Yeah, I can't believe that passed me by. I don't know what I was doing in 2004. I wasn't watching the news or reading the newspapers. And I clearly wasn't visiting Madame Tussauds either. See, the thing is, he had to give that £155 to, I guess it, I don't know if it goes to Madame Tussauds, it might have just been paying like court fees, whatever. So Madame Tussauds might not have got anything, but I tell you what they did get, pages and pages of publicity, yeah. So they probably did all right out of it in the long run. Anyway, while I was studying nativity scenes, there's loads of countries that have got specific different traditions about their nativity scenes. So I'm definitely going to come back to this subject. Maybe not next episode. Maybe not the episode after. Maybe not the episode after that. But it might be. We don't know. It's very exciting. So, you know, get ready for the next time I talk about nativity scenes. But right now, I've finished talking about nativity scenes for the time being, and I'm going to move on and do this.
So, I don't know if it was last episode or the one before that, but I was whinging that I was having trouble finding podcasts to talk about or to listen to, because like I keep telling you, I'm a gardener, work on my own, 40 hours a week, listening to podcasts, plus the driving time as well. Maybe it's more than 40 hours. Maybe it's nearly 41 hours. I don't know. Anyway, I received an email from listener Kevin Church, and he gave me a whole bunch of podcasts to listen to. A few of them I've already listened to in the past, but one of them that I really have been enjoying is called Under the Influence with Terry O'Reilly. And I'm going to read out the blurb as it goes on Apple Podcasts. Under the Influence gives listeners a rare backstage pass into the hallways, boardrooms and recording studios of the ad industry. Join host and ad man Terry O'Reilly for fascinating and humorous stories that connect the dots between pop culture, marketing and human nature. There you go. So what it is each episode, it's about half an hour long, maybe 40 minutes, and he talks about stories of advertising, and it's really interesting. I highly recommend it. It's been going a good few years, like over 10 years, so there's loads of back episodes for you to listen to. And yeah, like I say, if you don't even have to be that interested in advertising, you just have to be half interested in popular culture, and I think you'll really enjoy it. So check it out. Like I said, it's called Under the Influence with Terry O'Reilly. And of course, thank you to my mate Kevin Church for giving me that recommendation. I really do appreciate it. And that is it for this episode. I really do hope you've enjoyed it. I want to say thanks, of course, to Kevin Church again. Thanks to my mate Bob Baker and, of course, Benji Pearson and Chris Kavanagh. All the people that have sent me anything worth chatting about. If you want to get in touch, if you've got anything you want to give to the show, I'd love to hear from you. Any stories you want to share with us or any thoughts you may have, please get in contact. My email address is totalchristmas@gmail.com. The website is totalchristmaspodcast.com. I'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, you know I love you. Merry Happy Christmas.
I'm sorry I ruined your lives and crammed 11 cookies into the VCR.